I'm Molly Wood, and for Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Lizzie has the week off, but she'll pop in later in the show to talk about her European adventures. Also, the final chapter of The Uncertain Hour, our look at the 20th anniversary of welfare reform. And in this week's conversation, your stories about the best bosses you've ever had and the worst. We'll find out what put them in your hall of fame or your hall of shame. We'll also give them a little advice, hopefully not too late, on how they could improve. Do you have a story of your own to share? Tell it, please, by visiting marketplace.org or chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. Search for Marketplace Business News to find us. Or you can call us up, 1-800-648-5114. Let's start this week with a look at winners and losers. We brought in our panel of experts to play long and short. We'll bet unofficially, of course, on which trends are here to stay and which ones are going to fizzle out fast. It's kind of like they do on Wall Street. My guests today are Mike Isaac, tech reporter at the New York Times, and Marketplace's own Kimberly Adams. Hello there, fellow information traders.
Hi, Molly.
Hey.
Let's dive right in because I think we have a lot to talk about. Let's start with you, Mike. What are you long on this week?
This week I am long on citizen journalism, especially with the rise of streaming video smartphone apps. You know, now you can fire up Facebook and start streaming something immediately, right? What is it? In the past 2-3 weeks, we've seen people stream protests. We've seen people live stream the aftermath of multiple shootings. I really think that this is something that's totally, A, not going away, and B, actually hit some sort of tipping point that we haven't really got to before.
And it's interesting. I was doing some reporting on sort of what the smartphone means to the protest movement this week. And I was out at some of these demonstrations and seeing people holding up their smartphones almost as a symbolic motion as opposed to even recording anything. And I talked to some people who study this as well as some of the protesters. And they were saying, look, this means that not only do I see what you're doing, but the whole world can see what you're doing.
The power is undeniable, but are you really long on citizen journalism to the extent that it actually changes and disrupts and takes away the power from our own outlets?
No, I think you're right. I think I'm curious as to how it will diminish, say, like the New York Times. But like, you know, in these shootings of Dallas police officers over the past week, we were seeing this on Facebook before the reporters are able to even get there. And this has sort of always been the case, but it's on the journalists, the professional journalists now, to see how we, if you want to say, curate that in our larger sort of pieces. I don't think it's going away, and we sort of have to figure out how to adapt to that.
Let's move on to your pick, Kimberly. What are you long on this week?
This week, switching gears to something a little bit more upbeat, I'm long on Nintendo because, of course, everyone all week has been playing Pokemon Go. But that's actually not the only reason I'm long on Nintendo. They just announced this week also that they are going to be releasing a version of their classic Nintendo Entertainment System from the early 1980s. Remember that gray box that,
NES,
if you're old enough,
for the win.
that you had to blow in to clear it out, and you're playing like elevator action and duck hunt. So they're re-releasing a version of this, and they're playing up this nostalgia thing big time. And just if you look at Pokemon Go, that thing is making about $1.6 million a day, according to some analyses. I think that especially since everyone was so depressed this week in America, this was exactly what people needed, and now they are ready to cling to nostalgia, and Nintendo's ready to make money off of it.
I mean, you could see it as Nintendo sort of trying to get rejuvenation from its old product line, right?
Yeah.
And you know, frankly, I was on Twitter this morning and saw a bunch of people, 20s, 30s, folks that grew up with the old gray box and hit that sort of pang for, you know, the blowing in the cartridges moment. And like, oh my God, this is something I miss so much. And frankly, I will probably buy this myself. But you can't reinvent everything you used to have that was big, I guess.
I guess that's the problem. Although this is appropriate coming from you, Mike, because I believe you're short on a very similar topic.
I'm actually short on Pokemon and probably to a greater extent Nintendo, just in that, you know, I'm thinking about like the history of mobile games, but in games in particular, it's a very hits driven business, right? And at some point, I will actually collect them all, right? And then I don't know what to do with myself. Actually,
you're going to catch them all,
right,
Mike.
Right, right.
You're
going
to catch them all.
Oh,
Mike.
Yeah,
catch
I apologize. All. Yeah. But I mean, once you get to that point, I don't know. I mean, it's really, the onus is really on these game developers to create more mechanics to get me to want to come back, yep. right? And I don't know if I see that in them, at least not right now, you know, at least not 5-6 days after the game was released.
Right. All right, let's not forget that we are, in fact, a finance and economics show, and we should turn to the headier subjects. What are you long on, Kimberly? I know you're here to bring us back into the world.
Oh, gosh.
The real world.
Yeah, let me be the boring person. Thanks, Molly.
No, okay. I was trying to set that up. Like, this is serious business here that we're about to do.
Serious stuff. I am short on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, ooh. The huge trade deal that all of these nations around the Pacific Rim worked out to try and open up free trade across the Pacific. It's one of President Obama's big initiatives that he's been trying to get done before he leaves office, and things are just not going well. Both of the presumptive presidential nominees are saying that they're not really on board with it. The Republican Party, traditionally a party of free trade and go trade and trade is great, they are even backing off the TPP because Donald Trump, who is different from all the other Republican candidates we've seen, is saying he's not on board with it, so they're backing up. The Bernie Sanders supporters on the Democratic side are really pushing the Clinton campaign away from it, not to mention labor unions are not on board, and they're huge supporters of Hillary in this campaign. And so pretty much all of the stars are lining against the TPP. And so Obama is out there trying to campaign for Hillary, while at the same time she's out there trashing his trade deal. So I'm short on that.
I got to say, that's a pretty intense prediction. I would imagine that the economic theory of sunk cost alone would cause people to say, you know what? No, we negotiated this for 7 years, people.
So I guess I should say I'm short in that it's going to get done before Obama leaves office. And a lot of the leadership in Congress is saying the same thing, that it's unlikely to get done, although some people think there's a little window in the fall after the conventions where maybe they could push it through. But I don't know, man. Congress doesn't tend to get much done nowadays.
It's just going to have to be an evolved form of the TPP as if it were, in fact, a Pokemon. Full circle.
That was good. That was really good.
That's Mike Isaac from The New York Times and Kimberly Adams from Marketplace. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks,
Molly.
This next story is a story about an exit. Don't worry, I don't mean Brexit. But it's also about what happened after the exit. See, the ride-hailing companies Uber and Lyft recently left the city of Austin. That departure came after voters upheld local regulations that required drivers for those companies to be fingerprinted as part of their background checks. Uber and Lyft said they can't operate that way, and they rolled on out of town. In the weeks since, other ride-hailing companies have rushed in, 10 of them, to be exact, none of whom seem to have a problem with the fingerprinting thing. Each has its own phone app and fleet of cars. And as Audrey McGlinchey from NPR member station KUT tells us, this land grab is making for a crowded market.
All right, so I'm outside my local Y and I need a ride home. So I'm going to open my phone. I have Fare, Fasten, Wings, Ride Austin, InstaRide, and Scoop Me. I'm going to try Fare. Pull this one up, just click on it. I sat 10 minutes in the hot Texas sun before my air-conditioned savior in a Prius pulled up.
Hey, Robert?
Yes.
Hey, Audrey, nice to meet you.
Robert Gonzalez, who tells me he goes by Bobby, is friendly, but not exactly a talker. I prod him with questions. Does he drive full-time? No. He's got a full-time job as a semiconductor technician. But about a year ago, he started driving part-time for Uber and Lyft. So where does that extra money go?
I have 3 college kids, so that's pretty much my ride-sharing money goes to.
When Uber and Lyft left town, Gonzalez wasn't too worried. Driving was not his main source of cash.
But I do worry about most of the drivers that I know that are relying on this full-time.
For those drivers, it was touch and go for a few weeks. But then the newcomers rolled into town.
My name is Michael Leto. I'm the CEO of Fare.
Leto's a risk taker. Even though his company had only been operating in Phoenix for 9 weeks, he was carefully eyeing the vote in Austin. Polls closed on a Saturday night. It was clear by Sunday morning that voters had upheld the fingerprint regulation. Leto went to bed that night, unsure what Uber and Lyft would decide to do.
When I woke up, I, you know, went onto the apps. I dropped a pin in Austin, and both apps said, you know, we are no longer serving the city of Austin. That day at about 12:30, I got on a flight. I was here at about 4:45 p.m.
Leto set up a temporary office at a hotel, and the next day was at City Hall signing up for a license. The following week, Fair was cleared to operate, and within 2 weeks, almost 2,000 drivers had signed up.
There wasn't going to be an opportunity like this in the country, and we just jumped on it as fast as we could.
That's because what had happened in the Austin market was unusual. Companies had created demand both among customers and drivers and then suddenly left. Leto says Fair now has 6,000 drivers. That's compared to Uber's estimated 10,000 drivers. But remember, they're not the only players in this exit tale. Leto with Fair was the first, but many others have pulled up behind him. Like this guy, Vlad Kristoff.
I'm a co-founder and chief operating officer at Fasten.
2 months ago, Fasten was only operating in Boston. But then
Austin happened. Plan was to move to other markets quickly, and Austin was on the list. But it wasn't second. What happened here, however, changed things, and Austin became the second market.
Kristoff won't reveal how many drivers have signed up with Fasten, but contends the company is doing well here. At least 8 other companies have swooped in, becoming part of what feels like a ride-hail gold rush. The city's been plastered with flyers, competing logos, crowd driver windshields. I've seen one with 3 of them. But Kristoff isn't fazed by the competition.
We believe that this is not a winner-take-all type of market. We believe in competition. I mean, it keeps everybody honest. We compete for both drivers and riders at the same time with everybody else. So we encourage competition. You know, the more the merrier, actually.
But Leto with Fair says, nah, he's come here to dominate the market.
We're going to rise to the top.
When the time comes, the rest will fall away.
When the cream does rise to the top, you know, the others are, you know, probably going to have to pull out, and that's not going to be our company.
No doubt some will fail. But in the meantime, these ride-hailing companies will continue to duke it out. Eventually, it'll be up to the customers to decide who makes it big in Texas. In Austin, I'm Audrey McGlinchey for Marketplace.
And now let's talk to you. Last week, we asked you to tell us about the best boss you've ever had or the worst. What made him or her a pleasure to work for or a nightmare? Listener Judith Black tells us about her experience with a great boss and a not-so-great boss.
Hi, my name is Dr. Judith Black, and I am a clinical mental health counselor. Best boss was back when I was a crisis counselor, and he just really truly led by example. He wasn't afraid to get out in the field with us, and he never told us to do anything or suggested anything that he wasn't willing to do himself. That's the sign of a true leader. Worst boss was when I joined a failing startup, and my first sign should have been when the leadership became a ghost. Second sign should have been when I was still generating money along with a lot of my colleagues, and we weren't getting paid, but we found the owner posting on social media tweets from Mai Tais on a tropical vacation. That would be the worst boss. Company ended up closing, and, you know, through the years as a 25-year military spouse, I have learned, you know, leadership runs along a continuum. You've got really bad bosses, toxic leadership. You have amazing ones, and what you have to do is take the best of the best and really learn from the worst of the worst and make sure that you are not one that no one wants to align with, but you're one who learns to empower others to be the best version of themselves ever.
Our next listener had to move across the country to get away from a bad boss. True fact, I've done that. Okay, well, halfway across the country.
Hi, my name's Sam, and I'm in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and actually moved here from Illinois because of a bad boss. I had requested some time off to go to my cousin's wedding, which was also going to double as a family reunion, and he pretty much told me no. And I had begged, you know, months in advance for when the wedding was going to be. I told him all I needed was like 2 days, maybe a day, to fly down to Florida and then come back at night. I just want to be there for the wedding and see my family. He said no. And we were going into a maintenance turnaround at the plant I worked at. So it was kind of a big deal that I'd be there. But we had coverage for my responsibilities. But even so, he said, no, you can't go. It's unfair treatment to the rest of the employees, blah, blah, blah. And if I was able to quit right then at that moment and walk out of the plant, I would have, but I didn't have a job lined up, so I couldn't. But 6 months later, when I put in my 2 weeks notice, I let HR know exactly why I quit. That was the reason. I told him, hey, and he wouldn't let me go to my cousin's wedding / reunion, so this is why I'm leaving. But that's my story, and you know, not to feel like I'm entitled or anything, but my family's really important to me, and I just made the decision right then that I wasn't going to sacrifice for that.
So how can you be a better boss? Sydney Finkelstein is a professor of management at Dartmouth College and author of a book called Super Boss. That's why he's here. Thanks for joining us, Sydney.
Great to be on with you.
Let's start with the basics. Why do some people make just abysmal bosses? What's the biggest mistake they make?
The biggest mistake that the lousy bosses out there make is that they think that the world revolves around them. And if that sounds like a kid, it's exactly right. It's people that think that whatever they say goes, they don't have to listen to anyone else, and they set the rules. And that's just not the way business should work, and that's not the way people get better.
So what do good bosses do differently then? What's the positive side of that?
Well, there's a lot that the best bosses do. They try to hear everything they can from people that work for them. They want to get ideas from people. They unleash their creativity, if you will. They're looking for opportunities to help other people get better, and they can do that by finding new job assignments, expanding responsibility, creating more autonomy, all of those types of things. And you know what they also do is they value what people say. And so when you're part of a team and every player counts, everybody has something to say, and people listen, the boss is listening to you, it is incredibly affirming. And I think that's one of the biggest things that the best bosses do.
Do you think that's something that they get taught as they are moving up the ranks? I mean, it sounds like you're describing what some people refer to as soft skills.
It is. It's true. There is something to that. Although, you know, not all the best bosses are soft touches. To be sure, they could be pretty tough. But I think you can learn it if you pay attention to it. A lot of it will depend on who your bosses were as you've gone up in an organization. Your own experiences. You see what works. You see what you learned. You see what others have done. And hopefully, you've learned. And you can learn two different ways. You can learn what to do if you have a great boss, and if you have a lousy boss, and you really have a sense of mindfulness, you can actually learn what not to do as well.
So what about if you're an employee? Because even if you don't have people reporting to you, there's still arguably management skills at play, right? What can you do to manage up?
Yeah, the key thing in managing up is to earn the trust of your boss. You want to be as reliable, as important as you possibly can to her, to him. Make sure that they can rely on you. And it's really a question of trust when you get right down to it. A lot of the problems that happen with the bad bosses is they don't really trust other people. But if you can earn the trust of your boss, you all of a sudden get that seat at the table. You get an opportunity to kind of push back and challenge, ask for more, and they start to listen to you because you become really important to their own success.
It kind of sounds like what you're describing is life skills. If a person is the type of personality who is not capable of listening, can they really become a good boss over time?
I think that's going to be really, really tough at some point. I mean, you might be, it depends on the job. If you're working independently, you don't need a strong team. Let's say someone who has, you know, a salesperson who has his own territory, if you will. You could get away with certain things perhaps for a while. But as soon as you're a boss, a manager with other people, if you're not listening, I mean, a lot of CEOs I've spoken to have told me, you know, listening skills are among the absolute most important skills that any one of us can possibly have. And it makes a big difference. So, you called it life skills. I think that's right. I think it's about being a real person, it's about being a good person, and it's about being able to communicate effectively with your team just to try to get whatever you can out of those people and to help them get better.
That's Sydney Finkelstein from Dartmouth College. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Molly.
Now, as the national political conventions get underway, you're going to be hearing a lot about agreements, compromises, finding common ground. So for the next week, we would like to know about a time when you had to make an agreement or a compromise that affected your finances. Give us a call at 1-800-648-5114 or send us a message on Facebook. To find us there, search for Marketplace Business News. Let's turn now to Europe and the UK. I guess we should all get used to saying it that way. Immigration was one of the key issues that drove British voters to want to leave the European Union. In most of the EU, workers can move freely from country to country, and no EU nation has embraced migration more than Germany, which has an aging labor force. In addition to European workers, Germany accepted more than 1 million refugees last year. Your regular host, Lizzie O'Leary, went to that country to see how they're being brought into the workforce.
On the assembly line at a Mercedes truck plant in Wörth, Germany, Catherine Schnurr, who works for Mercedes, shows me an engine dangling on a giant metal chain.
He's preparing the frame right now, and then what they're going to be putting in the engine.
Oh, wait, is that... So that's an engine being lifted up, and then it will get dropped into the frame?
Yes.
The man we're watching is named Wasim. He's 40, a Syrian refugee who fled Damascus 2 years ago. We're not using his last name to protect his family.
I live wunderbar here.
Everything is fantastic here. I'm extremely satisfied with my time here, except today I'm very unhappy because tomorrow is the last day of the program.
That's the voice of our translator, Kate Hersey. The program runs for 14 weeks. Wasim and 300 other refugees are working at Mercedes plants across Germany. They're from Syria, Iraq, Eritrea, Somalia. The training isn't really about learning to make a Mercedes. There's no guarantee of a job afterwards. Though the refugees can apply for formal apprenticeships once they meet Germany's work standards. It's more to get a taste of being in the workforce here. The refugees make minimum wage for 3.5 hours a day and learn German for another 3.5. And they've been sent to the plants by the German government job centers. The program is funded both by Daimler, Mercedes' parent company, and by the German government.
Hi. Lizzie.
Yes. Aisha,
welcome.
Aisha Osbabashan runs the integration office in nearby Stuttgart, and it's her job to help outsiders settle here and find work.
That means language courses, provide language courses, sports, cultural activities, and of course, the access to a labor market, which is a very, hotly debated issue.
45% of people in Stuttgart were either born abroad or are the children of immigrants. Traditionally, they've come to Stuttgart to work at the big companies here, like Mercedes, Porsche, and Bosch. Recently, Germany's right-wing and Euroskeptic party, the AfD, campaigned on opposing immigration. But since the Brexit vote, support for the AfD has dropped. Some 9,000 refugees have settled in Stuttgart over the past year. And Aisha Osbabashan, who is a Kurd originally from Turkey, says one of the small pleasures of her job is using her own life story to show them a path to succeed here.
They are just saying, we are so proud that someone of us is working for the city administration. And I wish it also for my children that they get the same chance as you did, as your family did, to start a new life here and to be an important part of the society.
She says she has multiple identities, Kurdish, Turkish, German, and a very important one, European.
That is Lizzie O'Leary, and she's here now. Hi, Lizzie. How are you?
Hi, Molly.
Let's talk a little bit about this sense of European identity. Like you said, it is made up of so many different parts. And so why choose Germany specifically as a place to explore that idea?
Well, we went to Germany for a couple of reasons. I think number one, obviously, it is the economic powerhouse of the European Union. The economy is doing well there. It's really been the state behind a lot of the bailouts of the southern states. And the other thing is support for the EU in Germany is quite strong. We actually saw it increase after the Brexit vote, which was pretty fascinating. Oh. So before the vote, 39% of Germans said that Germany benefits from EU membership. After the vote, that went up to 52%. And, you know, as I mentioned in that piece, there is a right-wing kind of Euroskeptic party called the AfD in Germany, and they had been, you know, winning support. But after the vote, support for them went down. It was almost as if there was this sort of collective moment of thinking, gee, we do like being a part of Europe, and this is an important collective institution for us. The other thing that I think is important, you know, Germany has a pretty aging population, aging labor force. So they have benefited in a lot of ways from immigration in recent years. And I talked to a woman named Muhterem Aras. She's a member of parliament in Baden-Württemberg, which is a very prosperous state in Germany. That's where Mercedes is and Bosch and Porsche. So lots of big companies are there. And she said a big part of what she and her colleagues need to do right now is sort of explain to the German people why, in her view, they benefit from EU membership. You will hear her speaking in German and then the voice of our translator.
Wir haben seit 70 Jahren, Gott sei Dank, Frieden.
We've had 70 years of peace, and for many of the young people, they haven't experienced anything differently. So they can go and work somewhere else. They can travel somewhere else, they can study somewhere else. But I remember when I was growing up and I wanted to go to the French city of Strasbourg, which is only a couple of 100 kilometers away, and I just wanted to go for the day, I had to get a visa.
And now, obviously, you don't have to do that. You know, the free movement of labor and the single market, those are the big pillars of EU membership. And, you know, I met certainly a lot of young people who were moving around between countries. And then Aras is pretty interesting to talk to about this stuff because she is originally from Turkey. She's Kurdish. She came to Germany when she was 12. Her dad worked in some of the companies in Stuttgart where we were. So, you know, you do have both this influx of immigrants and you do have people who are very skeptical of the EU. But in general, people were supportive of it in Germany.
And I imagine that they will be watching the next couple of months and years very carefully because Germany is going to play a key role, obviously, in how the UK's relationship with the EU moves forward. What did people tell you there about how they want that relationship to look?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that is really interesting, they recognize that Germany is the big player here, that Angela Merkel is going to have a very strong hand in whatever happens next in the sort of Brexit negotiations. And support for Merkel went up after the Brexit vote as well. She will dictate, I think, you know, some of the terms of the negotiation. We don't entirely know what the British stance is going to be. Theresa May, the new prime minister, said Brexit means Brexit. But, you know, again, no one actually knows what that means.
Right.
There's this question of, is there a single market? That's the big one out there. When you look at the two countries, they do have pretty strong trading relationships. So the UK is Germany's number three trading partner. Germany exports more cars to the UK than anyone else. So that's obviously a big issue. You know, the UK, I spent some time in car country there, and they do send cars to Europe as well. You know, if they were to revert to, say, WTO trade rules, we'd be talking about 10% tariffs. I think that's the extreme version. But, you know, these are the kind of details that have to get ironed out here.
Yeah, absolutely. And even before that, before those details start to sort of come to the table, what's the buzz? Are people in Germany talking about this a lot? Is it the big topic in pubs?
Yes and no. One of the things that was interesting to me is I would say there were two kind of groups of people for whom I said, oh, I want to talk to you about Brexit, and they would immediately talk. And on the one hand, those were older people who remembered the war or had sort of grown up in the shadow of the war. And for them, being European and that sort of 70 years of peace that Mutra Maras talked about, that was very important. And then on the other hand, you had people in their 20s who have only known a Germany within the European Union. And for them, you know, the idea that they can move back and forth, that they can work anywhere in Europe that they want, that they can go to school anywhere they want. These were kind of tenets of faith, our tenets of faith. And so I think those were the people who were paying the most attention to this. Kind of some of the people in the middle, they're like, meh, I'm going to go to work. I don't think it's really going to, you know, change all that much of what I do.
But then you weren't just in Germany, you were also in the UK for a week. I imagine there's a little more conversation there, considering the ongoing shenanigans in the political realm.
Yeah, I mean, it was nonstop there.
Yeah.
And I should say, I was in two places in the UK that were incredibly different. So number one, I was in London, obviously the financial center, economic center, and heavily Remain voter territory. And then I went up to a town called St. Helens, which is about 20 miles from Liverpool. And that's heavily Leave territory. So 58% of them voted to leave the European Union. And everybody there, you know, they had what I would describe as just frustration with London, with the elites. Their votes weren't necessarily about immigration. They were about what they said was sort of feeling abandoned and feeling like no one was paying attention to them. And you felt that sort of in this town economically because it used to be a place that made glass. Pilkington's glass factory was there. And they still make a few things, but, you know, no longer is it 20,000 people a shift. We're talking, you know, handfuls of that at this point. And so you started to see this real split between people in the UK about feeling included in the modern Britain and then excluded from it. So it was a really interesting dichotomy to kind of be in the two different places. And then, you know, in London, it was just bonkers, if I can use that word. I was in the BBC newsroom when Boris Johnson stepped aside, saying he was not going to run for Tory leadership, although now he will be the foreign secretary. And people were kind of shouting and screaming, and it was unlike anything I have ever witnessed, probably, in politics, which I've covered off and on for 15 years. Molly?
Wow. I am a little jealous of your trip, but welcome back, Lizzie, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
20 years ago next month marks the passage of welfare reform. And we've been covering what's happened since then on our new podcast called The Uncertain Hour. The biggest changes did things like put limits on how long someone could be on welfare and create a system of work requirements. Now, in our final installment of the podcast, Marketplace's senior correspondent Chrissy Clark looks at another transformation, the role of education.
About 10 years ago, Tressie McMillan Cottom was confronted with a small but confounding mystery. She'd just started a new job at a cosmetology school in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was in a strip mall next door to a seafood restaurant,
a gas station, and a convenience store.
That's the campus.
That is the campus. That's right.
Tressie's job was to enroll new students in this school.
In a 9-month cosmetology program to help them with their financial aid paperwork.
This was not your typical college admissions job.
It became pretty apparent to me early on that the types of students that I was working with,
mostly very low-income women of color, often single moms,
needed a whole lot more from me.
More might mean Tressie would end up holding a crying baby during a meeting with a prospective student.
That was more common than having them show up with, say, their parents. I held babies. I held hands. I gave them rides home when their boyfriends took their car and the buses had stopped running.
And then there was this one request prospective students kept coming into Tressie's office with that she really wasn't prepared for, when they would slide this piece of paper onto her desk
and say, yeah, can you confirm that I was here today? Right? Can you certify that I was here?
The paperwork all these women were asking her to sign was a very specific set of paperwork.
Their certification paperwork to remain eligible for their welfare benefits.
What was your reaction at first? Is this like, wait, what is going on here? Why does this keep
happening?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because there had been no, this was not part of my training for the job at all.
Tressie spent a lot of time wondering why so many students kept sliding welfare paperwork across her desk. At first, she thought maybe it was just happening to her.
I go to some of the senior admissions people in the office and ask them about it the first time it happens. And they go, oh, yeah, we do this all of the time.
Not just filling out welfare paperwork, but dealing with other parts of the welfare bureaucracy.
I fielded phone calls from their caseworkers who needed to confirm that they were indeed enrolled in a what we call short-term workforce credential program.
And that thing that Tressie just said.
Short-term workforce credential program.
She wouldn't realize it until later, but that was the answer to her question. Why are so many students coming to me talking about welfare? Because her beauty school specialized in short-term workforce credential programs. Tressie hasn't worked for the cosmetology school in years. Today, she's a professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. But she's kept thinking about that experience she had with the beauty school students and all their welfare paperwork.
And that's the question that ends up animating like my research later as a PhD student and now as a sociologist and professor, which was, how did that happen? And this is what I've come to.
What she's come to is that it all comes back to welfare reform. But let me back up a bit. If you've been listening to Marketplace over the last couple months, you might recognize this music. This song was, in its small way, a sort of anthem for the welfare reform movement in the early 1990s. And the message of this song, to get off welfare and get a job, any job, was at the heart of the battle over welfare reform. There was this sort of fork in the road back then,
As welfare rolls grew in the 70s through the early 90s, policy wonks and politicians and the heads of county welfare offices were debating how best to get people off welfare. And two main approaches were up for debate. One road, investing more welfare spending in education. Basically, helping welfare recipients who'd often dropped out of school get more skills, a GED, maybe even a college degree. Joe Hutz, a labor economist that specializes in welfare policy, says the idea was that more education
may make welfare recipients less susceptible to the ups and downs of the labor market. Maybe it'll lead to a more long-term position in the labor force. Maybe it'll lead to higher wages, and maybe it'll build self-esteem.
In one way or another, the theory was they'd fare better in the job market and not need welfare anymore. The other road welfare reformers were considering has come to be known as the work-first approach. This approach dismissed all but the most basic education as a waste of time and money. Instead, the best way to help people on welfare, according to the work-firsters,
get people into a job immediately. We're not going to train you for years. We're not going to send you to school for years. We're going to show you how to find a job.
That's welfare reformer Larry Townsend. He also happens to be the man behind that song.
Join the workforce, don't be afraid.
And in the end, that song and the work-first approach won out in the debates around welfare reform. Which brings us back to Tressie McMillan Cottom, newly arrived at her job at that cosmetology school in the mid-2000s, a decade after welfare reform had kicked in. When reformers decided to take the work-first approach and leave the education approach behind, that decision brought a lot of new work requirements and time limits to the cash welfare system. Before welfare reform, you got a check based on your economic need. And what you did with your time after that was up to you. Maybe you worked a little or went to school on the side. But since welfare reform, in order to qualify for a welfare check, the average person has to spend at least 30 hours in some sort of, quote, work activity.
Those who are receiving welfare benefits need to either be working or to be doing everything in their power to be working as quickly as possible.
That might mean volunteering at a job or going to a job search club where you're coached on how to find a job. But if you want to pursue any education and still be eligible for welfare at the same time, you only have 12 months where your schooling counts as your full work activity. After 12 months, you can still go to school, but you have to add another work activity on top of school for at least 20 hours, which just makes everything hard to juggle, which is why a
short-term workforce credential program
has become one of the only practical choices for people on welfare who want to pursue an education. These programs are geared specifically towards training you for a particular job, meaning no degrees in English literature, too vague, not even a nursing degree, takes too long. In fact, one of the only simple ways to get an education while still qualifying for welfare since welfare reform is to sign up for something like that 9-month cosmetology program that Tressie used to enroll students in back in North Carolina.
And I went, oh, that was why I had so many women presenting their credentialing paperwork to remain benefits eligible for TANF.
That is temporary assistance for needy families, aka cash welfare.
Just by the virtue of how the social policy was designed and implemented, there are only so many programs that qualify.
So what do you make of this? Was this a good way of helping people become more skilled so that they could lift themselves up?
You know, can you get people into a job? Short-term credentials can absolutely do that.
But Tressie says, when you're talking about a population as vulnerable as the folks cycling through welfare programs, typically single moms with a couple kids living on less than $700 or $800 a month,
who bring with them a host of risk factors for reentering into poverty, right? They're more likely to have not completed high school, for example. They're more likely to have housing instability, all things that make finding and keeping a good job and skilling up very challenging.
She says for people in that situation, already facing so many challenges, sometimes a short-term certificate program just doesn't give them enough time or training to really help them find a job, let alone
good work, sustainable work, long-term work. Short-term certificates and credentials may not be that, especially when they're short-term credentials that are very expensive.
In Tressie's academic research, she's also discovered that while sometimes short-term credential programs are offered at community colleges, in many places around the country, the only school you can find one is a for-profit school, like the cosmetology school where she used to work. Back in the mid-2000s, a 9-month certificate program there cost about $15,000. That's the kind of price tag that will almost certainly require piling up a lot of student debt, an especially bad thing for someone on welfare, already struggling financially.
If what it was supposed to do was actually change the quality of poor people's lives, short-term credentials, especially when they're high cost, may not be at all the type of social prescription we want.
Tressie says, by effectively limiting the education choices of welfare recipients to these short-term credential programs, welfare reform has limited the ability of some poor struggling families to climb up the economic ladder. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
You can hear a very different perspective from a welfare reformer who believed in work first over education. That's on The Uncertain Hour. And also, we partnered with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX for a special Reveal episode on welfare. You can download The Uncertain Hour on iTunes or anywhere you like to podcast. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. After an interminable stretch of primaries and caucuses and debates, just like that, we have finally arrived at the presidential conventions. And this is a big milestone. The Republican National Convention starts Monday in Cleveland, Ohio. The Democratic National Convention a week after that in Philadelphia. Marketplace will be there covering both of them. Here's Andrea Seabrook, Marketplace's brand new Washington bureau chief. Really, people, she's like 2 weeks in and she is off to the races. Hey, Andrea.
Hi.
Is this your Marketplace radio debut?
You were
with NPR before, right?
Yeah. But this is the first time on Marketplace.
You're jumping directly into the fire. You're off to the Republican and then the Democratic National Conventions. Tell us, though, how that works for Marketplace. Why should these listeners care about a convention? It doesn't seem like the most obvious thing to affect their finances.
The answer is you're so right. And they are. So, we, the listeners of Marketplace, are so right. It is not. Conventions actually kind of don't matter anymore. And here I am telling you, hey, I'm about to go cover these things that don't matter. But that
so
is.
So it's a junket.
Not a junket. Here is why they don't matter. Because all of the sort of ossified political systems of the 20th century do not make sense in the 21st. And what Marketplace does, what you do, and what this show does, is describe a world where there are economic insiders and outsiders, people who understand that they have a line on wealth, and other people who understand that they would like to create it, but they don't quite know how. Mm-hmm. Politics reflects the economy in that way. Politics is really just a reflection of what is actually going on. The parties themselves don't necessarily reflect that. And that is our sort of thesis in our coverage of the elections, that the parties and the conventions, they don't make a lot of sense, but there are a lot of important things to pay attention to here.
Yeah, and inside out is kind of the theme. You're going to be hosting, I've never even heard this phrase, and I've been podcasting a long time, a pop-up podcast called Politics Inside Out. What can we expect from that?
Well, a couple of different things. For one, the point of Politics Inside Out is to say we're turning this on its head. We are not going to take any of the conventional wisdom and assume it's true. Second, we are taking questions from our listeners, thoughts from our listeners, recorded, sent in to politics@marketplace.org, if I can get a plug in there.
Of course.
We're taking those into the convention and getting answers for our listeners from people inside the convention. And conversely, we're going into the conventions and taking policy ideas, economic ideas, and taking them out of the convention. We're taking them out and covering them from the streets around the convention and the people all across the country. So that's sort of inside out. The other thing is that the axes, the poles of political thought in American politics have changed radically in the last 20 years, at least. And this is the first election where it's very, very clear that left and right don't matter anymore. I know that's kind of like a shocking thing to say. But like, for example, big government versus small government, liberals versus conservatives, those definitions, they're completely outmoded. The only way to look at American politics and the economy, by the way, and global markets, by the way, is that there are insiders and outsiders. There are people for whom government and the economy works, and there are people who are left out. And our sort of thesis is forget left, right, forget big, small. The modern world is defined by in and out.
Doesn't that make even these conventions sort of fundamental to what Marketplace does? Like, we're ultimately talking about income inequality, the Gini coefficient, the difference between the poles.
Absolutely. You are absolutely right. I think the reason why American politics has shifted to an in-out mode is because income inequality in our country has reached a level that has never been seen in a Western productive democracy. The difference between your social mobility, if you are in, you know, the lower 80% of American incomes versus the top 20%, the difference is huge. And the thing is that in this new mode, the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movement, they're no longer on opposite sides. They're on the same side. They're people who don't have access to political power, be it on the old right or left. Who cares about that? It's now about who has access and who doesn't.
That's Andrea Seabrook, our brand new Marketplace DC Bureau Chief. I look forward to your coverage. Thanks.
Thank you, Molly.
And that is our show for this week. Next week, Lizzie is back just in time for those presidential conventions, where I imagine you're going to be hearing a lot about agreements and compromises and finding commonality. So tell us about an agreement or a compromise that you made that affected your finances. Did you get what you wanted? Was it possible to make everyone happy, or did everybody lose? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. You'll find us by searching for Marketplace Business News. Or you can call us 1-800-648-5114 and your voice may be featured on air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer and Deborah Clark is our vice president. I am Molly Wood. This is APM.